what's the use in worrying about the ways in which the
world... This is Mary Huff from Southern Culture on the Skids, and you're listening to Asheville FM, community radio, baby.
Welcome to Making Progress News for a Change for the week of August 18th, 2014. If that's not the week you are in currently, either you have a time machine or you're listening to the archive from last week's show. The live link is at the top right of the Making Progress show page. My name is Barry. Thanks for joining us. You can contact us at makingprogress@ashevillefm.org or follow us on Twitter at News for a Change. And on Facebook at Making Progress News for a Change, one word. And of course, all the topics we talk about on the show, the links are available to follow along at the Making Progress show page at ashevillefm.org, as well as a link to hear that last week's show if you missed it. My name is Barry, and as usual, my co-host in the studio is David Lynch. David.
Good evening, everybody.
And we're very excited to have a guest co-host from our past. And current as well. Happy to welcome Steve Rasmussen. Steve?
Glad to be here. Thanks.
David, Steve, and I have a history going back some years that you'll hear about that's relevant to the topics we're going to talk about. So, David, tell us what you'll be talking about in the first segment.
Well, everybody has got their eye on Ferguson, Missouri. Today, the governor announced he's going to be sending the National Guard to Ferguson. And I want to talk about how we got there. It seems like the National Guard is just what they need, more military presence in Ferguson. How is it that with our local law enforcement we have so much? And I'm going to talk about the history of domestic military in our country and the policies that got us where we are today.
And Steve, what will you be talking about tonight on Making Progress?
Well, Barry and David and I worked together on police reform issues some years ago, starting in 2003 when Asheville was still under the regime of Chief Will Anarino, as you'll recall.
Bless his heart.
And we, you know, after getting beaten down by the police at the end of a protest, we started looking into what was going on with Asheville Police, and I think we formed Asheville Justice Watch, and I think we'll all be talking a little bit about that.
So we'll talk briefly about that, but then you're also presenting for current issues in Asheville.
Planning and zoning. Yep, that's the most powerful commission in the city as far as affecting your daily life, even more so in some ways in the city council, and there happen to be three seats coming up for possible changeover. But more than that, I just like to let people know what they can do to influence their lives.
Great, important topic. And later, I'll be talking about some of the latest developments in the drone issue. Making Progress listeners will be the most educated people in the state on drones, I hazard to say. The Tea Party is getting into it. There's quite a bit of movement on the topic. So that's towards the end of the show. So, David, start us off. Sorry.
Well, it seems that, as evidenced in Ferguson, Missouri, the war on drugs and then the war on terror have evolved into a war on U.S. citizens. And in this war, the police have become the terrorists. They have killed over 5,000 American citizens since 9/11. And you're 8 times more likely to be killed by a police officer than a terrorist in this day and age. So the war on terror seems to be flipped on its head. And it wasn't the way we really were supposed to do it. The original architects of our government didn't want the military to be involved in domestic policing operations for a lot of reasons. They didn't want the ability for a coup to happen. They wanted American citizens to have a more localized law enforcement presence. And they started off by passing the Insurrection Act of 1807, which limited the ability of the President of the United States to deploy troops within the U.S. to put down lawlessness, insurrection, and rebellion, instead relying on the governor of each state and local governments to initiate a response when something went awry. And that was coupled with another bill called the Posse Comitatus Act, which was passed in 1878 and then updated in 1981. And it restricted the federal government's use of military personnel to enforce state laws. So obviously there's exceptions. The National Guard can be called, but it needs to be called by a governor. Or it can be called by the governor of another state if that governor of the other state requests the neighboring state to provide troops. And it was actually once called by the President of the United States during the 1992 Rodney King riots in L.A., which I had the pleasure of experiencing up close and personal. And the only other exception I saw was the Attorney General can ask for emergency assistance, but it has to be in the case of nuclear materials. So there's very few exceptions. That still wasn't enough for George Bush in 2006. He urged Congress to repeal laws restricting presidential use of the military and wanted to be able to deploy armed forces in the case of lots of things, natural disasters, terrorist attacks, even maybe a public health emergency, and actually got his way with the National Defense Authorization Act of 2007. But luckily it didn't last long. By 2008, it was repealed and limits were reestablished for presidential power regarding the U.S. military. So there's never been a lot of public or political support over using the military domestically. But there is always a way around something. And with the help of the federal government, local police have been able to transform themselves into basically paramilitary agencies. And that's what we have now. And it started with our buddy Ronald Reagan. He signed into law the Military Cooperation with Civilian Enforcement Agencies Act, which allowed the military to cooperate with local law enforcement, and that was ostensibly to fight the war on drugs. And then in 1990, also to fight the war on drugs, Congress revised the National Defense Authorization Act to allow the Secretary of Defense to transfer to local law enforcement surplus military equipment. So small arms, ammunition, armored vehicles, and in some cases, even aircraft and larger weapons. This was originally called the 1208 program, but it was replaced in 96 with what is now known as Section 1033. So this military buildup of hardware, equipment, and tactics within our local police forces has been going on for about a quarter of a century, and we're just starting now to wake up to it.
And I'll just jump in to suggest, if we go back to the roots of this, back in the 1800s, the beginning of America as a country, as a union of states, and all of the balance of powers between the federal government and the states and so forth, I think it's a fair perspective to look at this and say that a big part of why we've gotten to this point is because so many Americans have so many guns. That this is why the police feel justified and the military feels justified in ramping up the counter to the private use of guns is, oh, well, the law enforcement has to have even bigger guns and more of them than the public does. So I'll just throw that in there.
And in the last 24 years, the Department of Defense has transferred about $4.3 billion with a B dollars worth of equipment to local law enforcement. And they can either purchase this stuff for pennies on the dollar, or in some cases get it for free. They can go online to get it. There's defense contractors that are hosting trade shows that they can visit to get equipment. And some of the bigger equipment, like if you need an armored vehicle, well, you can't just get that online. You got to fill out a one-page request form. You know, you have to jump through some hoops. So
Currently, you fill out
a whole page. And one of the big problems is that these 1033 procurements are not required to be matters of public record. So neither the giver nor the recipient has to divulge any information about what's transferring hands. And that's not the only program we've got that's making it easy for local law enforcement to get their hands on this equipment. After 9/11, to combat the war on terror, the newly created Department of Homeland Security began spending vast sums of money on grants to equip local law enforcement with more military-grade weaponry. And then the Department of Justice has the Edward Byrne Memorial Justice Assistant Grant, or JAG, program. And that's another way that local law enforcement can get this equipment. And they can spend their own money, which a lot of times they get through asset forfeiture. So if you're busted and convicted, a lot of times if you're a drug dealer, they can take your house, they can take your bank account, they can take your cars. And there's even been a few cases where people haven't been convicted or even charged with a crime, and they've had their assets seized by local law enforcement. And you may wonder what that's led to. Obviously, you saw it in Ferguson, and the ACLU's been on this for a while. In June, they issued a report called War Comes Home, The Excessive Militarization of American Policing. It's about a 93-page report. You can go to the ACLU and download it. And they came up with quite a few startling conclusions. They said that those 67% of Americans think that we should be more focused on treatment than policing and prosecuting drug users. That hasn't stopped anything. It's been militarization full force ever since. They say in recent years, local law enforcement have received 15,000 pieces of battle-ready merchandise. They estimate that 500 police and sheriff departments have received mine-resistant ambush-protected or MRAP vehicles. I think that there are two in our county, according to this New York Times interactive map, which you can go look at and find out what equipment you have. Because I tried to use this ACLU report because they issued a slew of Freedom of Information Act requests to find out what every state and every county was doing. And they reached a lot of stonewalling from the other side.
And if you're interested, you can go to the Making Progress show page at ashvillefm.org, and there is a link to that New York Times interactive map.
So most of this equipment, of course, it's like anything. If you got a hammer, everything you're looking at looks like a nail. And most of these heavily armed SWAT team home invasions that are violently used are to serve low-level drug-related search warrants, and they've become very routine. And the ACLU reports that 79% of SWAT departments that they studied were for the purpose of executing search warrants, which could be easily done with a marshal unless they suspect that it's going to be a lot of resistance. And, of course, the SWAT teams often justify the forced entry because they suspect the presence of weapons. Though after all these searches have been done, they found it weapons were only present one-third of the time. So two-thirds of the time they were wrong about the weapons, and they went in like gangbusters, and often with deadly results. Injury, children have been killed. And there's lots of anecdotal information in the report.
Many cases of mistaken identity. They went to the wrong house and at least on a few occasions have killed people who resisted armed intruders into their house and only then realized that they were in the wrong house.
Right. And a lot of times people don't know who's bursting into their house. So it's not a good recipe for a successful search. There's not a lot of standards. There's no criteria that somebody can say, why did you decide this was a high-risk situation that you had to come in with a SWAT team? It's at the discretion of the police force, which doesn't have the training of a military to do such things.
One thing I've noticed quite a bit in these police justifications of why they do the things they do. And there's a lot of emphasis in police departments on policy. It doesn't mean it's always followed, but when investigations start, that's where you look. Well, one of the policies they have is something called a force continuum. The idea being that there are different levels they ratchet up until they get compliance from the citizen, the final level being deadly force. But more than that, the focus is always on protecting the safety of the officer. So that's why, you know, you'd think like in the movies, if the, cop's going to save the victim from the bad guy, he's going to shoot him and disable him and bring him in for justice like Gary Cooper. No, they aim for the center of mass. It's always shoot to kill.
Right. They don't shoot to incapacitate. They shoot to kill. That's why they're trained these days.
So, you know, on the one hand, we're told that you know, we should look at police officers as our heroes, just like we're shown on TV. On the other hand, they aren't necessarily trained to see our lives as more valuable than theirs. I think it's the other way around.
You know, and in case anyone's perceiving that any of us, and the three of us have been talking about these issues for years, don't value the lives of police officers or think that police officers should simply lay down and let criminals kill them. That's not at all the direction we're going. We're focusing on the fact that the policies and the trends that are going on are leading us in a bad direction, and police officers in the long run will be in more risk because the population will trust them less. There'll be less clarity over when lethal force is used, and situations get ramped up to where there are violent encounters. And we're simply arguing that there should be a closer look at how to keep everyone safer, including citizens and police officers.
When we were working on Asheville Justice Watch, we actually had quite a few allies in the police force because they were pretty disgusted with how the top-down system worked. And that's most police forces, unfortunately, are very top-down. It's a pyramidal hierarchy, and they take their orders from the top. They don't always have a lot of individual discretion. When they do, they're not necessarily trained how to use it. So it's something that a lot of police officers wanted to see here, is a lot more training about de-escalation. And
right, and it's not just for criminal cases where you're going to serve a warrant or there's a call for a criminal event. It's starting to become the war on dissent as well. So more and more of this military equipment's being used to quell peaceful protests. And so a peaceful protest is met with armored vehicles that have rooftop snipers, and then there's rubber bullets and tear gas and new technology. And sure, in Ferguson, there's been some rioting, but there's also been some peaceful protests. And they're all painted with the same broad brush and treated and responded to in the same manner, which is messy, messy.
One of the things we discovered in our investigation of how things had gotten to the state they did in Asheville with the police force was that a lot of veteran cops complained to us that rookies were being put out on the street. They're the ones that panic. You know, they're afraid. They're not familiar with situations that may not be as dangerous as they think. And that's certainly one thing to bear in mind when you're dealing with face-to-face with an angry policeman next time.
So after reading this ACLU report, my next question was obviously, okay, well, how much stuff does my local police department have? How much does the Asheville Police Department have? And I found that the ACLU of North Carolina had done a lot of statewide Freedom of Information Act requests for every county, every city, and it's pretty comprehensive, the stuff they were requesting, but here's the information they got back from the Asheville Police Department. They asked, okay, can you send us copies of agreements between the APD and branches of the military or even private security enterprises concerning SWAT teams? What are you doing with that? And they said that they had nothing in their possession. They were asked for records relating to funding sources or grants applied to or received by the APD SWAT team, which is called the ERT. And they referred to one budget line item for ammunition in the amount of $14,000. And that was it for the emergency response team. They were asked for a list of cutting edge weapons and technology, GPS tracking devices, facial recognition, cell phone sniffers, drones, shock cuffs, things like that. And they said, this is not a request for a public record as defined in the NC general statutes. So they're probably saying that they have that information, but we don't have to give it to you by law, so we're not going to. They were asked to give an inventory list of military equipment that either the APD applied for or received through the 1033 program, and they said we have no such items in our possession, which I don't know if that means they didn't have a list or what. And they did disclose receipt of an $8,000 grant from the Department of Homeland Security that they received in April of 2013. They divulged that they got a little robot that they can throw with a camera on it to not put an officer in the line of fire.
I saw the video for that robot. It's hilarious. It's the size of a cat. It's small. It's basically the size of a rolled up newspaper. And you really can just pick it up and throw it. And the video shows them in their testing. They pick it up and throw it against the wall, and it just gets up and continues to roll around. But I was watching. I was like, really? That cost $10,000? Give me a break.
It did. And the ACLU did get the 2011 and 2012 reports for the APD's version of a SWAT team, which is called the Emergency Response Team. Their mission is to save lives. And like you said, it might be their lives. I don't know. They boast that through 2012, though, no deaths or injuries have occurred in any of their operations. It's a 14-member team. They participate in an annual 40-hour week-long training course and then 10 hours every month as well. And they're issued what constitutes basically riot gear, including ballistic helmets, body armor and shields, breaching equipment, sniper rifles, selective fire and suppressed weapons, riot control agents and launchers, and what they call less than lethal impact munitions and launchers. In their 2011 report, they deployed as a small team 42 times. They deployed as a full team 10 times. 40 of those deployments were for search warrants. 8 of them were considered high risk. And then I'd love to see the 2013 report, which was not part of the ACLU's, what they received from the APD. But in 2012, it escalated quite a bit. The small team was deployed 53 times. The full team went from 10 times to 29 times. 38 of those deployments were for search warrants, and now 35 of those situations were considered to be high risk. And the report stated that their old armored personnel carrier would be replaced by a Lenco Bearcat MRAP vehicle in May 2013 through a joint purchase by the APD and Buncombe County Sheriff's Department. So that's about all I was able to cull from what the ACLU was able to get from all those Information Act requests. It's not a lot. And just to wrap this up, there's a National Journal article that says that the 1033 program isn't going to end anytime soon. So really, you got to ask yourself, who benefits from the militarization of our local police? And I dare say it's the defense contractors. This is a great new lucrative market that they can tap right into. Companies like Lockheed Martin and Black Hawk Industries aren't making enough from the wars that we're waging. So here's a great new market. They're, like I said, they're hosting arms expos and helping local law enforcement find new and exciting ways to spend their DHS grant money. And so now that our police have the paramilitary capabilities, they don't want to give it up. In May, now this wasn't from the department, but 126 Seattle police officers filed a lawsuit to a judge to issue an injunction to freeze the use of force regulations and provide financial compensation for officers who are disciplined or lose wages for violating use of force policies. So they're saying, we want to keep doing this stuff, and we'd rather not follow the law if we don't have to. So really, maybe these events in Ferguson are a blessing in disguise, because people really are waking up. It exposes how far the militarization of our local police departments has come. But it's going to take a national outcry to reverse this trend. And Congress is starting to respond to the outcry. There's some legislation being introduced, but we'll have to wait and see if any of it gains any traction and we actually see some of these laws getting reversed and some of this militarization being dismantled.
Well, it's certainly starting a national dialogue, and that's a good thing, and we will be following it here at Asheville FM and, of course, making progress. Thanks very much, David. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about the three of our experiences 11 years ago at the hands of the Asheville Police Department. You are listening to Making Progress, News for a Change. We'll be right back.
Sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the walk where I walk. Watch out! We run New York. Policeman come with
I know this for a fact. You don't like how I act. You claim I'm selling crack, but you be doing that. I'd rather say see ya, cause I would never be ya. Be your officer, your wicked overseer. Your hot shot, wanna get pops and be a savior. First show a little respect, change your behavior. Change your attitude, change your plan. There could never really be justice or stolen land. Are you really for peace and equality? Or when my car's hooked up, you know you wanna follow me. Your laws are minimal.
KRS-One here, making progress. In honor of the United Nations International Day of Peace on September 21st of every year, Peace is Possible NC will present the film Peacemakers. This film is a fascinating interview with Prem Rawat of the Peace One Day and Peace One Day founder Jeremy Gilley. This event this year will be held at Handmade in America. That's at 125 South Lexington Avenue, Suite 101 in Asheville. That starts at 5 p.m. and will include live music and refreshments. For more information, call 259-3030 or visit peaceispossiblenc.org. And we're going to continue our discussion briefly about the whole police and use and force issue. As I mentioned earlier, David... Stephen and I first started working together in 2003. We were all participating in a march on the day that the invasion of Iraq began in 2003. And Steve and I were among 30 or so Asheville residents who were forcibly grabbed by Asheville police, and some more forcibly than others, and thrown into a paddy wagon just because... Not because we were actually breaking anything or hurting anyone. It was just, we found out later that the word had gone out in the morning for the jailers to expect 30 people. They were going to arrest 30 people and just to be ready for it. That came down from the Asheville police. And so they were definitely sending a political message to Asheville protesters, telling the jailers to be ready for 30. And Steve and I were in that first batch of 30. And Steve and I and your wife, Dixie, I remember, were in handcuffs for quite a while outside the Buncombe County Sheriff's Office where they were detaining us. And I remember as they were booking us, I look over, I hear a commotion. I'm being fingerprinted, and I look over and see a commotion. And I see Steve Rasmussen in midair, horizontal, about to be slammed into the ground by a Buncombe County sheriff. Tell us why it was that you were horizontal and about to be slammed into the ground.
I objected to his removing my marriage ring, and so he just did some deft maneuver that literally laid me flat on that cement floor. And
I don't know how deft it was. All I know is there was this frozen moment where I see Steve
yikes,
horizontal about two or three feet off the ground. It's like, that's not going to end well. Yeah, he didn't want you to, you know, like Arlo Guthrie. They took away his wallet. They took away his belt so he wouldn't hang himself. And then they took away his wallet so he wouldn't have any money to spend in the cell.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Well, they didn't want you to demonstrate that you were married in the cell.
They do have a Starbucks in the holding cell
anyway,
now, don't they?
Anyway, we kid. But listeners, do go to the Making Progress show page on Asheville FM. And you'll see a couple of things. For one thing, you'll see the video of that entire event by local activist slash musician Shane Perlowin, who got a bunch of different videos from that event and put them together to music. Interesting to go back and look at it. So there's a link to that video, and there's also a link to the report by the group that Steve and David and I were members of, along with a number of other people in town, Asheville Justice Watch, on APD, citizen complaints, use of force issues. So if you're interested, go back to that. And that was written, when, 2005, Steve?
Yeah, January 2005, we presented as a report to the then new chief of police, Bill Hogan, who was the first police chief ever chosen in this town with public input.
Which, I remember that.
Yeah, it did make a big difference.
All right, well, please do go and check that out. But we want to change gears here a little bit and talk about one of the other powerful institutions, shifting away from the police for a moment, one of the other powerful institutions in the city of Asheville, the Planning and Zoning Commission. Steve?
Well, Planning and Zoning Commission is a volunteer board made up of seven folks. Five of them are appointed by the city. Two of them, for reasons that are hard to explain, are appointed by the county, even though they don't, you know, the city doesn't have a lot of jurisdiction over the county. But it's basically their function is to not only approve or disapprove developments based on the city's UDO, Unified Development Ordinance, but also to plan for the future and look ahead to how Asheville's changing and growing and try to, recommend to city council changes that need to be made. There's, in the past, the Planning and Zoning Department was basically a province of the development community. It was, in many ways, a rubber stamp. That's changing, I'm glad to report, because just as the police department has gradually been reforming here, so also the rest of city government, as more and more citizens get involved, and there's more and more of a push for transparency and public input. So we actually, I feel that we, at this point, have some pretty good folks on planning and zoning. Even the people that I thought might have been very... that came in swinging, anti-regulatory, laissez-faire, property rights are absolute. How can you stop anyone from doing anything they want to with their property, even if it's right next to yours? They moderate a lot because once you're actually a citizen participating in government, you realize it's just not that black and white.
Yeah, and listeners may remember there was a couple of high-profile things a few years ago that were appointments that were made that were a little bit controversial, including one member who's still on that board, Holly Schreiner. Her husband, she and her husband owned a major piece of property or were co-owners of a major piece of property and didn't disclose that to the public. And apparently, or so they claimed, council members claimed that they did not realize that she was a co-owner, essentially, of a piece of property that was about to be a major piece of property downtown that was subject of some development issues. And I and others were very upset to see that she didn't have to disclose that she and her husband stood to make a lot of money off of the whatever the decision was during her term.
That's where the Harris Teeter is now, yeah.
Yes, this was the Deal Buick property. And since then... Steve, maybe you can tell us, was there any change in the process after that?
Yeah, there was. There was city council has got a lot stricter about requiring full financial disclosure in the applications. And honestly, Holly kind of did a double take and decided, well, I'm going to do this job really well then. And she's actually, I actually have gotten to be kind of a fan of hers. She'll actually go out to a development and look at it, as opposed to just looking at a piece of paper with a map on it like is traditional with city commissions. That's one thing that I think people need to bear in mind is that it's something I've come to learn is it's not entirely, as powerful a board as it is, it's not entirely up to them. It's not entirely at their discretion. Citizens really have a lot of say in it, and one of the biggest says we've had is the back in around the 2001, I think it was, with a lot of public input, the city's overall master plan, they now call it the 2025 plan, was created. Well, this plan actually lays out some principles that if you understand them, if you apply them, if you remember them, if you get involved, you can actually convince folks that, yeah, maybe what you're saying is a good idea, and maybe what maybe a particular project isn't. It has to do with the actual principle of sustainability that we're supposedly based on. It's something called a triple bottom line, where your profit is not the only motivation that we're supposed to look at in any of these planning decisions. We're also supposed to look at its effect on the community, and we're also supposed to look at the effect on the environment. They call it profit, people, and planet. And it sounds like just an abstract, you know, CYA type of phrase, and sometimes it does get used that way. But I try to tell people over and over again that are, you know, just getting involved in maybe working for greenways or maybe working for bicycle transportation things, all of which come under the purview eventually of the Planning and Zoning Commission, to read that plan, just the beginning part. It's a very long plan, but read that intro and you know, understand those principles, because people that are honest on the board, and most of them are, I think, nowadays, are really trying to hew to that. And I think, yeah, we've really three people that are about to hopefully get reappointed by city council. Two of them, let's see, isn't Jane Matthews is one, right?
Jane Matthews, Christy Carter, and Jeremy Goldstein,
right,
are the three that are. Her terms are up and are asking to be reappointed. And there, of course, city council is opening up for other applicants to also compete for those three seats. So the people who are currently serving are not guaranteed to continue, but they can reapply. And before I forget, if anyone's interested, and as Steve is describing how important this board is, if you're interested in applying for a seat on the Planning and Zoning Commission or any city appointed body, contact Maggie Burleson. She's the city clerk. That's mburleson@ashvillefnc.gov, or her office at City Hall is 259-5601. And they will send you an application, and you can be a part of the process.
I really strongly recommend that even if you don't feel qualified, apply anyway. That's what I did a couple of years ago.
I wanted to ask about that. That was going to be my next question, is to tell us about your experience in applying and trying to get a seat on P&Z.
Well, I wanted to emphasize that P&Z needed to take another look at the 2025 plan and the UDO and try to really start looking at the whole picture rather than just piecemeal, one-at-a-time development approvals. I didn't get selected, obviously. In retrospect, I'm glad, because Christy and Jane and Joe Minicozzi did. And watching him in action, these are really, really sharp people who really know what, you know, really see what Asheville's vision is of itself, which is of a, you know, not Charlotte, need I say, walkable, pedestrian friendly, green.
But it should be said that there are people who would be happy to see Asheville turn into a very different kind of place than it is.
Well, then there's the folks who used to dominate planning, yeah, zoning, and some might say they still do. They just, generally when these appointments come up, SIBO, Council of Independent Business Owners, is right on top of them and puts a lot of pressure, although everybody will deny this, if they're on the record anyway, puts a lot of pressure on council to pick at least one of their candidates. Mm-hmm. And I can't prove it, but I think Jeremy might have been that candidate at that time. He came in very, you know, again, property rights absolutist.
Jeremy Goldstein, who at the time, and I believe he still, yeah, is a property manager.
Yeah.
His company manages, yeah, lots of real estate in town. And I bring that up because I remember when he was going through the questioning process, a lot of us were concerned about him because of, as I said, because of his role and his profession. And we wanted to see a little more balance. And he was asked, I believe, by Councilman Cecil Bothwell, are there any buildings that you can think of that currently have been built in Asheville that you would not have approved You know, this is after Mr. Goldstein had gone through and basically stated, as you laid out earlier, sort of property rights and people have the right to build what they want. And he sort of thought about it and said, well, first of all, there's a number of them that I can't speak of because I represent clients in those buildings.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, well, there's a red flag. But his other thing, not even the BB&T building, which many people for decades have realized or thought that, okay, that was probably a mistake to have allowed something like that to have been built. And he said, no, I'm not going to go back in time and second guess that. You know, who knows? It might look better decades later with other buildings around it, was basically his description of why it was not inappropriate to build a giant blank black skyscraper in the middle of Asheville.
Well, it's a scary thing, you know, is that I've noticed this in working on a lot of like the downtown master plan subcommittee, working with a lot of architects and developers, is that there's this a very similar kind of closed mentality that you see in the police department, where it's, you know, they can't understand how anybody would see things differently from themselves. And what they tend to see, especially the developers, the architects often have a problem with those, you know, big square ugly Soviet style buildings like seem to be getting built quite a bit these days. But the developers say, I don't want any of that fancy stuff. It's got to be as simple and as cheap as possible so I can make as much possible money out of that amount of square footage. There's no triple bottom line there. It's just about profit. No concern about your neighbors. No concern about this shadow being cast on, you know, the street. None of that. And that's where, you know, this laissez-faire philosophy that's so rabidly advocated by a lot of the pro-business folks, I have to say, just falls apart because it's too selfish. That's why you need government, is to moderate everybody's interests. And that's what I think, actually, I kind of see Jeremy coming around to that point of view, honestly.
Well, that's good to hear. And if there's an unbiased and objective observer to the issue, it'd be no one other than you. And so I take that as encouraging that PNZ is and some of the members are moving in a better direction. And
they'll probably prove me wrong on Thursday, but
yeah,
that's when the Haywood Road form-based code is going to be probably approved. And that's
the new designations for the West Asheville. They're changing or preparing. They're changing the template for how construction and development can happen in West Asheville.
And it's a pretty pioneering thing, honestly, and quite a bit of it's oriented towards historic preservation, which
and
I'm
that's
thrilled
this
to see.
Week. That's this Thursday.
That's this Thursday at 4 p.m. in City Hall, and it's the only lower floor of City Hall. It's the only item on the agenda. So maybe they're expecting a lot of turnout.
I would hope so, and I hope listeners check that out, and do, as I said, if you're interested, do contact Maggie Burleson at City Hall, 259-5601. Maggie is a wonderful person and a great resource, and she will send you an application right away and get involved. And this is a very important issue. And that's the only kind of issue that we talk about here on Making Progress. Thank you. Thanks very much, Steve. And when we come back, I want to talk about your side projects, the things that you do, that you love. You do this because you believe in it and it has to be done, but the things that you really love, we're going to talk about that briefly when we come back.
You shouldn't.
Oh, no, I should. I should. You are listening to Making Progress, News for Change. We'll be right back.
I'm beginning to hear voices. There's no one around. I'm all used up and the fumes have turned brown. I went to church on Sunday. A sheep has bowed. My love for her taking such a long time to die. And I'm waist deep in the mist. Almost like I don't even exist. I'm 20 miles out of town in cold iron bound. 20 miles out of town in a cold iron bound. the rules of pride. The higher the world, you can't see over to the other side. Such a sad thing, CBDDQ. It's sad as hell to feel your heart torn away. One look at you and I'm out of control. Like the universe has swallowed me whole. I'm 20 miles out of town in cold and bound. 20 miles out of town in cold and bound. To recall, I thought some of them were afraid to die. I was wrong about them all. Where the road is rocky, the hillside is moved. Up over my head, the thunder clouds of blue. I found my world. But your love hasn't been true. I'm 20 miles out of town in cold and bound. 20 miles out of town in cold and bound.
Welcome back to Making Progress News for a Change. We're right here in the middle of town and we ain't going nowhere. And we're going to go from talking about use of force, development issues in the city of Asheville, and we're going to move back to an issue that we talked about here a fair amount on Making Progress, is the possibility of drones in North Carolina. And I know I've spoken about this quite a bit on the show, but I wanted to come back to it, partly because of developments over the week that I think are going to be interesting for you to hear, and also because it ties right back to what we were just talking about. Now, let me remind folks the what happened after a long and tortured sort of process to get this legislation in place. There was everyone was very surprised to find that this badly flawed bill just sort of slipped into law during the discussions about the budget. It was slipped into the budget in the dead of night by who knows who and signed into law by Pat McCrory. So there is a deeply flawed bill that is now law that regulates drones and regulates them poorly, in my view and in the view of a lot of others. What's happened in the last week is you're not just seeing sort of blowback from folks like myself here at Making Progress, but the Tea Party has gotten into it. And when I say the Tea Party, you know, there are groups that actually call themselves the Tea Party. Asheville Tea Party is one. And there are groups across the state that are affiliated. And we're not just talking about conservative Republicans. We're talking about very conservative people who quite many of whom no longer call themselves Republicans. They have decided that the two-party system has failed them, as many people on the left do. And they're taking it from the point of view that and in speaking to some of them and going to their meetings, I found that quite a few of them are angrier about this drone issue than I am. And so one of the things that's happened over the last week is the Asheville Tea Party, actually on their website, if you go there, and there's a link on the home, on the AshevilleFM.org Making Progress show page. If you go there, you'll see that they sent a request to Representative Tim Moffitt and local Representative Chris Whitmire, both of whom are on the committee that wrote this legislation, sort of demanding an explanation as to you know, tell us why this was made law. We have we're very troubled by some of these provisions giving law enforcement massive sort of exceptions to needing a warrant to conduct surveillance. And the very interesting response from Representative Moffitt to them, and they posted this email online, was that not to worry, that legislation is not likely to go anywhere. This is 2 days after it had already been signed into law. He's one of the co-sponsors, and he claimed to not even realize that it had already been signed into law. And mind you, these are people from his right flank. This is his base. This is the people who he really needs. And it strains credulity to hear that he claims to not even know that it was signed into law.
Did he think they weren't going to look it up?
Well, I'd be very interested to see the follow-up.
Yeah.
There is some follow-up on that website, again, the Tea Party. I think it's safe to say that they're not buying it, and that they actually accuse him of treating them like they are stupid. And so that happened. And then a few days later, another site, which is the Daily Haymaker, which is a news site, an online news site based, I believe, in the Hickory area. I could be wrong. They came out with an article that's also linked on the website that's called Monkey Business. and they sort of leveled the same sort of criticism that the Tea Party in Asheville had. But they went further. They suggested that there may have been actual nefarious reason behind the fact that the Durbin bill got snuck into law. And, of course, they cite Representative Moffitt by name as the only legislator on there that they call by name. But the accusation is sort of based on the fact that there is a company called Olaris, which is taking up moved their headquarters from Texas to North Carolina. And as I was one of the people who attended some of the meetings of this committee in Raleigh, they were given essentially rock star treatment at one of the hearings to make a presentation, essentially make a sales pitch to these legislators for the state of North Carolina to purchase an entire, as they call it, a turnkey system, meaning from top to bottom, the actual hardware, the software, the training for the pilots. They would come in and they would install this for law enforcement statewide. They have these drones that are supposedly able to respond to 911 calls, to respond to calls from fire and law enforcement, to go in over an area and conduct surveillance to find out, for example, how many fire trucks descend to a fire, or if there's an assault going on, to have cameras that have eyes on before the police can get there. And so this is the system that they've been very aggressively marketing to the state of North Carolina. And this was part of their pitch. As I said, I was disappointed to go all the way to Raleigh and find that they weren't talking about protecting our civil liberties. They were getting pitches from drone manufacturers, but that's another story. In any case, what's happened since then is that this company, Olaris, who made quite a splash when they chose to move their entire operation here to the Winston-Salem area, it came out that they have been essentially threatening the Commerce Department of the state of North Carolina for months now. They gave them a deadline. You need to buy our drones. You need to sign a $6 million contract with our company to start installing these systems in various places around the state, or we will pull up stake and not just move out of the state of North Carolina. We're moving to India, and we are going to tell everyone that you ruined the chance for the state of North Carolina to become the home of the fledgling drone industry.
Oh, no.
I know. It's amazing. So I've put links on the homepage to a couple of the articles relating to this. And so this is the crux of the accusation from this conservative website, the Daily Haymaker, is that the laws that were put in place, the regulations on drones, do allow massive exceptions, as I say, for law enforcement. And the allegation is, well, guess what? They're doing that so that they can pave the way for this company to get this gigantic grant of taxpayer money to buy these drones. And they're alleging that it was this is corruption, that this isn't just, oh, we should be alarmed about our civil liberties. They're coming right out and saying that there's a possibility that this is a corrupt act. What do you think, Steve? You're laughing and shaking your head.
Oh, no. It's film incentives that are corrupt.
Film incentives are very corrupt.
But that does sound actually very characteristic of our legislature. Getting back to that bottom line, it's just about the business.
I mean, it actually is kind of shocking. If you go and read these articles, they've set a date. They've set a deadline, September 25th. If they don't get a promise of a $6 million grant, and this is a direct quote from the CEO, the future of the UAS industry in North Carolina, now rests entirely on Secretary of Commerce Decker's decision. They're sort of threatening that you know, all of the big investment, all of the big money that could flow to North Carolina, we'll make sure it doesn't if you don't give us our $6 million contract for unmanned aerial vehicles linked to law enforcement that will have access to North Carolina skies.
Even though the FAA hasn't even issued rules about this yet.
That's the other crazy part of it. As you're right, the FAA has not actually issued approval for the kind of system that they are marketing. It's called Beyond Line of Sight, that currently they're prepared to authorize use of drones that are controlled, you know, on the ground. You can see the drone. That sort of thing they are giving authorizations to law enforcement on a per-case basis. But the idea of launching a drone and sending it 20 miles away to investigate a 911 call, you need something that's called sense and avoid technology, meaning they need to be able to avoid conflicts with other aircraft or with power lines, that sort of thing. That approval is years away. That technology is years away. But that is the crux of their system, and they're still insisting that the state of North Carolina make this purchase. And so that's what the hardcore conservatives in this state are not taking that, and neither should we. And so I just wanted to lay that out.
So it sounds like it would be a flawed system, and we'd end up holding the bag. The taxpayer money would end up holding the bag, or the FAA realizes it's a flawed system. They pull the plug. They change the legislation, and the system can't be used here. Or, and we're holding the bag.
Or even worse, this becomes pressure to deregulate the skies faster than, because the economic pressure of this entire thing, both locally and nationally, will push towards the FAA loosening the regulations and issuing permissions for this sort of thing before they're ready. But in any case, that's the latest on the drone issue. And of course, pay attention here and making progress, and we will keep you updated on the latest. And before we go, I did want to talk about Steve's extracurricular activities, or actually this is the extracurricular activity. Tell us about what you and your partner do in your main part of your life.
Yeah, I just engage in politics for fun.
and we have like 1 minute for this.
Dixie Dearman, Lady Passion, and I have published a book called The Goodly Spellbook, Old Spells for Modern Problems, published by Sterling Ethos. It's now 10 years old, entering its second edition. We'll be doing a book signing at Malaprops September 18th and a couple others too. But it's about what we think on the religious left is the solution to a lot of problems. If you feel trapped by the wrathful God on the one hand or the soulless machine on the other, slip through the cracks and discover magic. That's my pitch.
And there's a link to Coven Oldenwild. As the coven that you and Dixie, Lady Passion, head up. And if folks are interested, want to find out more, they can go to the Making Progress show page and find out more about the Goodly Spellbook and Coven Oldenwild. And Stephen, thank you so much for coming. It's been great to have you here.
Thanks. Really enjoyed it.
And as usual, we've got more to talk about than we have space for. As Southern Culture on this Kid says, too much pork for just one fork. You've been listening to Making Progress, News for Change. Listen to us next week. We'll be back. Situation, nothing must be found.
the investment in creation set the whole thing upside down. And I want to relieve. I got a tune to leave, but now it's over my head. Yeah, over my head. Yeah. If you open your eyes.